We are in Champions League, man.
That was my
dilly din, dilly don. Come on.
Ancora Messi, 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 gol, 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 gol.
Into Sheringham and Solskjaer has won it.
I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
This is the Modern Soccer Coach Podcast with Gary Kernin.
Aguero.
Hello, welcome to the Modern Soccer Coach Podcast. My name is Gary Kernin. Joining us today is Eamon Devlin. This is a really, really good one. Half-time team talks. Are they underutilised? Are they ineffective? How do we improve that critical 15 minutes? Eamon is the founder of Minute 9, where he specifically advises sports teams and coaches how best to structure and manage the half-time period. Before we start, our friends at Veo have kindly asked me to test the new Veo Cam 3. And then they got a step further and actually sponsored a recent MSC breakdown where we took a look at the camera with a session. That session was with Santiago Castillo. It's on our YouTube page. It's also on our website. The link is below in the podcast description. Please take a look at it. Please check out this new Veo Cam 3. It's fantastic. Designed to give AI-powered tools automatically break down your game so it's ready for you to watch and analyze, automatically follows all the action, creates a broadcast-like experience. You can live stream the game, you can watch it immediately, you can bookmark crucial moments, all this, much, much more, plus faster upload speed as well. Unbelievable. If you're a coach looking for video solutions, if you're a coach looking to video the games without having a camera person, Veo Cam 3, definitely check it out. The link is below. I really appreciate them jumping on and supporting the podcast. And I really appreciate you listening. Here is Eamon. Enjoy.
Eamon, thank you for joining me on the Modern Soccer Coach Podcast. What a topic this is. Welcome.
Indeed. Thank you very much. Yeah, looking forward to this. Yeah, big topic. Lots to discuss, I think.
Where to start? It's such a big thing. Halftime, substitution, strategy, putting it all together. And obviously your role, and we'll talk about the halftime advisor element of this here. Why is this not something that is, in the world of marginal gains, you know, this is a pretty big, significant piece of the pie here. Why do you think it's not being utilized or maximized from coach standpoint?
I think there are probably two main reasons. One is the fact that, you know, what stays in the changing room stays in the changing room. So, you know, it's very hard to get data. It's very hard to get, you know, yes, there's some clips on, you know, Netflix, etc., but they're nearly all very highly edited clips. It's a bit of a very, you know, it's a very sacrosanct sort of place for teams, and that culturally that's meant that not much light has got in. And the other reason is I think a lot of coaches are a bit ashamed, I think, of how they perform at halftime, particularly in the halftime talk. So whenever I work with a coach or a team one-on-one, I always ask for a copy of a recent halftime talk that he or she has delivered. And to be honest, quite a few refuse to do that. And then I say, well, I'm not sure we can work together, because if you're not willing to look at your own performance, then I'm not sure this is going to work. And there's also the other thing to add is that there's very little research in this area, Gary. So there are only 8 published papers on halftime talks. And that covers all sports. And there's 2 in football. There are 2 in hockey, 1 ice hockey, 1 field hockey. There's 1 in basketball. But to give it, to put it in context, there's probably, 500 papers on people recovering from knee injuries alone. So, yes, very little research, very hard to get data. And I think people are quite reluctant to let people into the changing room.
The piece you sent over to me, when I looked at it, you know, there's words here that jumped out to me, and we'll get into that there as well. I guess this is a tough question, because I don't want to seem to be challenging the importance of looking at this here with a real good lens. But how do you start to judge the success of a halftime talk, without being completely outcome based?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think empirically it's probably impossible, because there's so many factors, of course, as we all know. And what wins a game? Is it the weather? Is it the players? Is it the emotions, the opposition, I mean, there's, you know, 100 plus variables. So to kind of, to isolate just one, I don't think is really possible. But I think you can go on, players, ask them what they think. So I think causation is very difficult, almost impossible to improve in this world. But I think there is a, I think you can get to a situation where players can inform management of how they feel, actually. And that was the base of the research, Gary. So we mentioned there's 8 papers on half times, but nearly all of them are from the coach's point of view. And it struck me, well, that's all very nice what the coach thinks, but maybe we should ask the players what they think. And there's only 2 papers on what players think. And it transpires that people jump into the coach's halftime talk as the biggest part of halftime. That's not what players think. You get a 15-minute break in senior soccer. You've only got, the coach speaks for whatever it is, 4 or 5 minutes. But the majority of the time is more than just a coach's talk. So I think there's a way of, just asking players what they think should happen. And it transpires that the coach's talk is not their number one priority at halftime. But coaches think that's the case.
1,000,000%. Because you're thinking of that there as a coach, and you're thinking, your 3 coaching points. But you're also going, we talked before recording, you're also a little bit of an improv at that stage, to where your 3 coaching points that you've just thought about walking into the changing room have now spun themselves in 1 8-minute monologue for the most part. Where do we start with that there? Do you agree with that there?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think there's at least two points to that. There's one, I think it's worth, I always say to coaches, look, just who do you think, what is halftime for? And just get coaches to really think about what is the purpose of halftime. And I think people give it some more thought, they'll probably realize, I hope, that it's for the players. And so therefore, it does not make sense to ask the players, do you think what should happen at halftime? As opposed to just assuming what we do currently, which is just almost like a lecture. The head boss comes in and all the other circus comes in as well, all the sub coaches and assistant coaches. The other challenge, of course, is getting people's attention. So players will demonstrate loneliness at halftime. Even though they're wearing the same jersey, you're playing for the same team, players will feel very lonely often at halftime. They feel under threat. If they're losing the game, the fight or flight button might have been pressed. So players have a lot to deal with in their own heads. And then to listen to the coach who, quote unquote, goes off on one on his 3 coaching points, which really is about 9 coaching points when you analyze the transcripts. Players find it very hard to remember and engage. And so we did a test recently with a team. A coach spoke for, I think it was 3 minutes. We then did a test on the players, what they could remember by the time they got to the grass. The results weren't very good. And that was only 3 minutes. So I think if coaches really, really realize how much players can retain, I think it would change a lot how much they speak.
Well, I actually think this is something that the recall of players, like there's interviews with top players who, because I think we feel that it's a classroom, we say that almost align soccer with academics, you're learning something, you're taking on information, but the recall is completely different. Because if you, there's players that, there's one I watched recently, there's players that score, stick in the top corner, and they're asked by Sky Sports after, what were you thinking at that moment? Like, I don't remember what I was thinking. Surely it's wrong for us then to be revisiting 45, like almost a match of the day inside 3 minutes of the first half, and asking every player to remember that and then spinning it in a different way. Tough ask.
It's very tough. And I think if I look at the sort of transcripts from the players, and that's all I have to go on, Gary. I'm a coach myself, but not at a very high level. All I have to go on is basically the word of elite players. And when I ask players, tell me about a half time, nearly all their first answer is, Jesus, I don't know if I can remember, much about half time, because I forget a very high portion, except for the ones, for the half times, which were different. The half times where the coach told a story and or the coach used a visual aid. So that's one of my big coaching tips for coaches, is to have some kind of visual aid, even if it's just a whiteboard with your 3 points written on it. Because it transpires that we think we make, you know, we think we learn, some lot of people think we learn from what we hear. The reality is we learn from how we, you know, from what we see. But 80% of the world you and I make up is through our eyes. And so people talk about visual learners. We're all visual learners, actually. It's not just a certain type of people. So if you have some kind of mechanic where you can demonstrate, you know, either on a statistical board or a whiteboard, that alone has got a huge difference to memory recall, because you're using what's called dual coding. So yes, the coach is using his or her words, but the players can also look at it. So you've basically got two chances of going into your brain and getting logged into your long-term memory through your eyes and or through your audio. Hopefully one of them sticks, and, you know, bingo, hopefully the players have a higher chance of recalling. Because if players don't remember what you say, then literally what is the point of chatting to them?
See the piece there you said about giving the players a bit more time. I think a lot of coaches would look at that and say, oh yeah, no, that's, you know, there's your 3 minutes or your 5 minutes, or, you know, depending on the level, or you've got a clock waiting out there. I think what a lot of coaches would struggle with is trusting, not necessarily not trusting the players, but trusting the collective to actually talk and discuss. I mean, could you test run that, or could you guide play? How would you fix that?
It's a good question. I mean, it depends on the environment. You know, I work with some teams where, frankly, so I generally suggest, but by the way, I recommend 9 minutes. And hence the business I have is called Minute Nine. It's a 15-minute break. I reckon for the first 9 minutes, the players are alone.
Oh, anxious coaches stand outside there, Eamon.
Well, all the more reason they're outside with their other coaches getting what they have to say really right. And also, the idea is to kind of create separation and also impact. Because if you believe the assertion that players are very stressed, they're anxious, they're tired, you know, their minds are flying. I mean, the analogy I normally use is, if you're the head coach, you have 25 airplanes. You've got your squad players and you've got your whole backroom team. These planes, hopefully most are flying on course. Some are flying at all slightly different elevations, different levels of fuel. Some are flying the wrong direction. Some have crashed on you. Some have been hijacked by their own thoughts. Then the whistle goes. How do you find a way of getting those airplanes to land somewhere, you know, safely under the stand? And I think that takes some time for people to decompress, to actually relax, and where they're ready to kind of talk and listen, as opposed to where some coaches come in and go, you know, you've had your 60 seconds, it's my time now to talk. So going back to the structure, I recommend as a starting point, 9 minutes with the players left alone. If you feel some teams do need what I call guiding questions, so if you've gotten your 11 players, I recommend that they're split into two groups. So maybe the keeper and maybe the back line is group A, and then your midfield and your forward line in group B. So you've got two circles. The guiding question I normally use, Gary, is in the second half, what should we stop doing? In the second half, what should we start doing? In the second half, what should we continue doing? S and C. Stop, start, continue. And the idea of that, if it's not obvious, is to get players to focus on the second half. Because if you analyze the transcripts of what goes on at halftime, most people are just commentating on what happened in the first half. The review meeting happens Tuesday or Wednesday, whenever the schedule is for your team. So it's trying to get people to focus on, well, okay, the first half has happened, what are we going to do in the second half? And the other questions, you can be like, what are we like in transition? What are we like, you know, going forward? What are we like defending? But then ideally, if you have got these three guiding questions, ideally the management team are discussing the exact same questions in their own huddle outside the dressing room. And then when the two groups meet, hopefully there's at least you're discussing the same, you may not agree what the answers are, but the two groups are discussing the same concepts. So in the first half, what should we stop doing? And what you're trying to generate is an environment where players start, you know, analyzing really what the problems are and what are the solutions. And it does take some time. And unfortunately, when people may do changes, it does, there's some chaos initially. So I think people go backwards before they go forwards. And then a minute nine, yes, the head coach comes in. But only the head coach speaks. That's one of the feedback points, Gary, from the elite players was they really do not like when four or five coaches talk at halftime. Because, well, who am I supposed to believe? Really? Is it Eamon or Gary or Gary's number two? Like, it's the head coach to speak. And ideally, you're looking at 60 seconds to communicate.
Physical environment. Two questions on the physical environment. First off, you're going to have a lot of coaches here that have that aren't fortunate enough to have locker rooms and are sitting in a corner of a facility or a pitch. Yeah. Any thoughts around, is that a challenge?
Yeah, it is a challenge. Yeah, I mean, the environment is very challenging. I mean, I had a team recently, a teammate in France, where rugby team, a very, very small dressing room. And then I said, well, who's in the dressing room? And he started naming like the board of directors and the owner of the club. I thought, well, what are they doing there? I said, it doesn't matter to me because they're not saying anything. So that's not the point. Your players are looking up thinking, oh, who's in charge here? Is it Gary, the head coach, or is it the shareholder over here? I think it's important to, I always say, look, unless the person's got a specific role, they shouldn't be in the changing room. Because even if you've got, you know, but yet everybody wants to be in there, right? The whole backroom team want to be in there. I think there's a, if it's going to be outside, then I still recommend you have your two little groups. Ideally, the players can take the weight off their feet if they can. But the big issue normally is there's people just what I call the hangers-on, unfortunately, who are not the other, you know, unless they have a identified role at halftime and they're there to help the players, I'm sorry, they shouldn't be in that room because it's an extra distraction. And you're literally just sucking energy out of the room.
The other question on the physical environment would be when they're sitting around, like almost like does that psychologically create a very classroom type environment where people expect the teacher to tell them what's wrong? Is there a better way to set up your structure of the room even?
Yeah, I think circles are good, right? Circles are good because then, you know, it's not a, you know, straight away you're not in a sort of classroom type dynamic. It depends what, you know, again, what limitation you have on size of room. But to be honest, to me, it's more important what words are used then as opposed to the formation. So another tip that I was recently given by a communication, actually a lady based in the States, so she recommended that before the coach gives his or her, you know, speech, they actually ask the team, hey, team, do you mind if I say a few words now? Do you mind if I give some feedback? Because one is respectful. You know, you're inviting people to listen to you as opposed to just assuming people are going to listen to you.
But Eamon, do you think they are? Like, if you say, do you mind if I say a couple of words, is it going to get to the captain saying, listen, I don't want to hear you right now. We're going to fix this ourselves. Like,
well, to be honest, if that happens, then that's success, yeah, I think.
I just, I don't think they'd say anything other than that. I might be wrong.
I think it's more of a rhetorical question. I don't think you're expecting them to say no. But it's just more about, look, maybe just priming someone to listen. Because if you accept the situation that players find it hard to listen, you know, players are, again, go back to the characteristics of what players are often narcissists in their own head. You know, they are worried about their own statistics. Am I getting in the back page of the paper tomorrow? You know, so to take them out of that world into your world, I think requires some steps. And I think there's an easy, you know, just by offering. Asking, you know, as I said, I don't need to be able to say no, but I think it's just, I think it's a nice way of just giving the generation coming up behind us, Gary. I think there's more expectation that's expected, and then maybe your first question can come another question. Like, well, tell me what you think, guys. tell me, you have these three questions, tell me what your feedback is. And it's really kind of designed to take, frankly, you know, if people follow that protocol, coaches end up saying less, and you could leave the players more in charge, as opposed to the old system where, right, whistle goes, I'm in charge now, do as I say, and you feel you have to run the whole 15 minutes. Just creates a lot of pressure for coaches.
Hello, coaches. We'll take a quick break here. Massive, massive thank you to our friends at VO for sponsoring this podcast episode and a recent MSC breakdown on YouTube where we took a look at the new camera, the VO Cam 3. We did a session with Santiago Castillo. I highly, highly recommend you check out the session and also take a look at the video. It's on the Modern Soccer Coach website, modernsoccercoach.com. It's also on our YouTube page. We take a look at the camera and the new features of the camera, the AI power tools that automatically break the game down so it's ready for you to watch and analyze. The VO Cam 3 automatically follows the action on the field and creates a broadcast-like experience where you can watch the game immediately and live stream it or bookmark the crucial game moments and watch later with faster upload speed as well. A number of new features. If you're aware of VO, please go ahead and check it out as well. The new features, unbelievable. Huge thank you to VO. Highly recommend that you check out the VO Cam 3. The links are in the podcast description. Thanks so much. Back to Eamon.
Really, really good road to go down here because you're talking about the next generation, a more individualized approach into a traditional group setting. It couldn't be less individualized because normally the coach is trying to, if they're trying to fix something, they're trying to fix a tactical problem with analysis and all that good stuff. If it's an individual problem, they're looking at a substitution during that. Very rarely, I think, do coaches think of impacting people individually. And I wonder if there's if we're missing out there in some way, or is there a way to make this more individualized?
Well, Mourinho famously would write written messages. You see him often scribbling notes 10 minutes out from the end of the first half. So he would often give out players individual messages. So like, which is very like, you know, if I, you know, got some paper here, like if I write you a message, I'm going to give you a whole page. If I give you a little message, you know, there you go, Gary. That is, there's a sense of touch that's been instigated, vision, and if you read it aloud, also kind of, so it's almost impossible for you to miss that experience. You know, that's a personalized message. It's in your hand. And I think that's one way, which is, I think, my understanding is highly effective. Now, I don't think you can do it every week, but I think occasionally, and it could be as simple as, I don't know, maybe you're the full forward and go, look at, you know, you're way quicker than the left full back. You should have a go at him or her, you know. So there's, that's one way. I think also you can, so that there's kind of a, so the research I did was definitely on the elite level. And the feedback I got was, if a player is not doing his job and he knows what his job is, he expects to be called out at the elite level at halftime. However, there's kind of a lot of people believe now that a lot of coaches are not sure willing to do that in case they seem to be the bad guy or they haven't got the confidence. And if the truth has not been told at halftime, then it's giving players another excuse to switch off. So if they know there's an issue to be discussed here and it's not being discussed, it's just giving players another cue just to be in their own heads.
Yeah, well, they need that player too in the next 45 minutes. Great story. Neil Collins, who brilliant coaches at Barnsley at the minute, was worked over here with Tampa Bay. Joe Cole played for him, and before then they were walking in, Joe Cole tells a story that Joe Cole said, have a go at me, and that'll get everyone going, you know, best player. And Neil wouldn't be backwards and coming forward, so he did what he was requested. And Joe Cole was like, Neil, calm down. Yeah. Even too much. But it's a brilliant way of, you know, little insights like that there, I think is really good. But let me ask you this. How then, without going down that direction, how then do you think a coach can actually hold people accountable at halftime with that element of emotion and with all the other baggage and pressure that goes alongside that? You mentioned there at the start, the isolated nature of halftime for players as well.
I think there were two main ways. When I think the way I normally coach myself is I normally just look at the, you know, the players that are doing the best and really hammer home, like, you know, look at Gary's doing on the left-hand side. He's getting up and down the wing. The player he's marking hasn't had a shot in the target. And so I think eventually then the person on the left wing will start realizing, oh, okay, that's how I get the coach's, you know, approval. That's maybe a softer way. Another way people, of course, use is statistics, you know, and stats. So I know some teams now who you know, they'll have people come in off the, you know, into the dressing room, and there'll be some like five or six statistics on the board. One of them may be which player has had the three least number of tackles. You know, and that's just purely factual. You know, and players come in and go, I don't want to be on that board. I better get my tackles in. So that's a way of demonstrating a factual reality without giving somebody, you know, a roasting or a castation. I think that can be a very effective way. Particularly if the stats are agreed with the players beforehand, you know, so they agree what statistics we should pull out and demonstrate at halftime. That's another way.
Brilliant. Yeah, that quote that you had actually has got statistics in there. Halftimes are now less psychological war zones, more ordered, stat-based, but they're also less truth flying around changing rooms. Yeah. And sometimes, we talked before we start recording, sometimes it's good, but also can come with a negative as well.
What, the fact there's less truth? Or the
fact that there's less of a war zone?
Obviously I hop around different sports. I think soccer is definitely the one which, to be honest, I probably find the hardest actually to get to coach, because culturally there are a lot of issues. You know, the coach, you know, will often feel the need to speak for a very long time. A lot of anger as well. But there is certainly an issue around. There's an issue around, I think, some coaches being able to demonstrate their personality. So if we go to one extreme, like what players say are the most impactful halftime speeches, they're generally ones about emotion, actually. You know, let's say you're 4-0 down, okay, you're a Champions League final, it just hasn't gone to plan at all. So let's look at the sort of psychological profile of those players. They might be thinking, oh, this is now a threat, the situation. It's not a opportunity. They might be thinking, oh no, we're in trouble here. You know, they're going to get slated in the papers. So the brains are on fire. I think the idea then of a coach going in and giving them a lecture on tactics, I'm not sure that's the most beneficial use of time. An alternative to that could be to inspire the players somehow, to use an inspirational speech, because there's no limit on inspiration for anybody. No matter if you're messy, it doesn't matter what you are, there's always room to have more inspiration in your life. And the best coaches I work with definitely have ability to tell a good story. But that work, obviously you can't do it every week. But if you spend some time in the off season and you have at least three types of halftime talks, then it takes the pressure off you as a coach, because you know you've done the homework, you know you've got something in your back pocket, and then you can use, quote unquote, the right halftime method depending on how the game has gone. But yeah, I think storytelling is a great. I mean, there's a great story by it's actually not a halftime talk, but it's about impact. So Brian Clough, I've kind of become obsessed with Brian Clough, I have to say, recently in the last few weeks. So Brian Clough, as you well know, he signed Trevor Francis, was it the first ever £1 million signing, right? 1979. Yeah. Press this is actually on YouTube, but the press conference is there. Lots of journos from around the world. and no sight of Brian Clough. Like, the chief exec was there and some other people, other officials from Nottingham, but no sign of Cloughy. So towards the end, Brian Clough walks in, looking pretty disheveled, wearing his squash outfit. Like, so sat down, almost turned away from, you know, the press and the and Trevor Francis. And then a journalist said to Francis, "Do you look forward to playing on Saturday?" And Trevor Francis, or Brian Clough, just said, "Mr. Francis will play when I pick him." End of press conference. Now, you might think, what's got to do at halftime? But Brian Clough completely made an impact. He had one sentence to deliver. And there's no, very unlikely that Trevor Francis forgets what that moment was like. So I'm trying to teach coaches to say fewer words, but have much higher impact. And I think that, and if players are left alone for a long period of time, the hope is they become more relaxed with each other and they're brought back to earth. And then they're in a space, hopefully, to listen to either some tactics or a good story.
There's a great, there's also a great Clough one where he's gone in the changing room at halftime and he said, "Sorry, guys, that's on me. I picked the wrong team." Walk back out. And everyone was like, what do you mean to pick the wrong team? They went out and won, obviously. But both those stories probably wouldn't transfer to today's player. But I think what you're saying is that the personality would, and it's the personality, and brevity of like able to deliver some. I completely agree. I think as coaches, when we're getting more information today, we feel a real responsibility to tell everyone and educate our teams around that, when reality is we'd be better off being a bit more strategic around delivery.
I mean, I had the lucky experience of interviewing Wenger, Arsene Wenger, about half times.
Oh, wow.
And Wenger was kind of laughing at me a lot. I think mainly because he'd worked all this stuff out years ago, 30, 40 years ago. Because Wenger, you know, was famous for saying very little at halftime, which is why I wanted to kind of study his approach. He realized that players haven't got the brain capacity to listen to long speeches. So he would pick and choose. He was often a 60-second guy. I remember he famously told me that if Arsenal was playing Tottenham in a big derby, you'd have to remind the players, because the players knew they were at war, so they were kind of fighting, that's fine. They were able to kind of, you know, put the tackles in and nullify Spurs. We had to remind them at halftime, but that's not our game plan alone. Our game plan is whatever the formation is. And so it was to remind the players, our game plan is going to win this game, not just being at war. So I thought he was, less is more, Gary, less is more. And funny, you mentioned about going back to if a team is losing by a lot and you think your team's up, you think your team's not trying very hard, I say to coaches, maybe don't enter the change room at halftime at all. Minute 9 comes, where's Coach Gary? Oh, he's not coming to see us today. We're so rubbish today, he can't bother talking to us. I guarantee you'll get a reaction from players.
You could be out of a job on Monday as well, though. That's the problem with that.
Wenger said the same thing, actually. The problem now of doing anything unusual, it gets leaked to the press, funny if you say that. So I think at the very, but not everybody's playing at that level, right? So a lot of coaches are, you know, at a different level. So, but it is I've seen it myself, used to good effect. I've seen another example, similar, a softer version of that, where the coach walked in, team's getting absolute trounced. Coach watching me, and I thought, well, I've thought about this. I think my best 11 are on the pitch. I don't know what the idea, I don't know how to fix these problems, but I think you do, and walk back out again.
If you've got really good career, if you're in that bracket of like really good delivery, that's going to be, I played for a coach that was like that, and you'd just laugh and you'd take responsibility. But I wonder if we're in today in an age where players are going, whoa, you're supposed to know that. That's not acceptable.
Yeah, but I wonder whether or not I suppose the underlying philosophy is we're sort of stuck in this system right now where players just not left to be their own, like to make decisions. Right? I mean, we before we went on air, we discussed, you know, where should the coach stand during the first half, and we kind of obviously discussed in soccer. Well, they stand at the dugout near the halfway line, you know, usually standing up, shouting things from the sideline. And I wonder, you know, you're almost just taking away power from players, telling him what to do or she what to do. You're just removing their confidence. And I think it's worth the experiment, giving players genuine freedom and space to make decisions. But it takes time. They need to be trained a little bit because they're not used to this power. And if nothing else, give it a go. But I think people will be pleasantly surprised that, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the experimentation and trying something a little bit different, I think there's so much of that needed. You mentioned about football being a tough culture, and it's very, very risk-averse. Coaches and talk before air about a lot of inferiority complexes around what you should know and what you need to know. This is something that I think you can get easy gains because, like, it's a safe environment for a coach to try that. And, like, I want to go back to Wenger, though. You mentioned that he laughed, and you mentioned that he had a giggle about that there because that's how he approached halftime. I mean, what was his take? He's big on coach development. Like, what was his take on your area?
Yeah, well, he also said, actually, he wouldn't like to be a coach today, funny enough. He would not, no.
Yeah.
Because of the damage with players. Yeah, he made that very clear. He basically made it very clear that, you know, you've got to give players time to be with themselves. You've got to realize that you haven't got all the answers as a coach, and ideally, you want to build a culture where the players find the answers, because, you know, if a problem happens halfway through 20 minutes into a half, you can have 25 minutes before you get to speak to those players, and the game could be over by then. So this idea. So I'll give you an analogy. So the All Blacks, I've had a bit of an insight into the All Blacks. Not this running of the All Blacks, but the sort of previous sort of coaching team of the All Blacks. And so you've heard of something called the captain's run. So the captain's run in rugby happens on. So let's say your test rugby's on a Saturday. Rest on Sunday, and then you train Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. When you get to Friday, for most teams, the coach takes the session, and the coaches don't say anything. So they head to the captain runs the whole session, with the view being, well, the players are in charge when the game starts. Why not give them more? But the All Blacks, they used to have their coaches end speaking by Wednesday afternoon. So half the week of training, the captains are in charge. On the basis of they want to create an environment where the senior leaders in the playing group, they're the ones you're kind of, you know, feel they can spot an issue and fix it. I'm not sure that's the same in football, where you've got this idea of control. I mean, apparently, going back to Brian Clough, you can tell I'm obsessed by him. His one of his talks, he apparently had a white towel in the changing room and the ball on top of it every half time. And at half time, he might just point to the ball and go, right, just, you know, when you get the ball, just give it to one of your teammates. And when you haven't got it, you've got to hunt like hounds to get it back. And that'd be it. And, you know, and people laugh at when they go, that's really simple. But the reality is, he's probably taken 30 years to whittle it all down to that and to have the confidence to reduce it down to one statement.
Yeah, brilliant. Have you seen the Neil Warnock one where he walks in? This is about 20 more years ago, Sheffield United, I think it was, where he walks in and he takes off. He's so calm, takes off the sweater, puts it down, and then boom. And again, pure, oh God, some of it's just nonsense what he's saying, but the impact.
I think, you know, those very ferocious ones, because I actually have a scoring system, and actually those are actually rated quite high, believe it or not.
Yeah.
It's the ones which are the most talks are not like that. They're mundane, monotone, ineffectual. That's the majority of what the ones I've seen. But of course, they don't get on YouTube because they're not, you know, they're not nothing special to look at. The really impactful ones probably have a place for sure. But if you bark, you know, there's expression in psychology, isn't it? If you say a lot of bad words, a lot of a certain tone, it just becomes wallpaper. It just people don't really, they don't listen anymore. It's just like they zone out. The other factor is, which came up in the research, is if a player had a bad experience as a child at halftime or in any sporting context, then they may be programmed to literally shut down at halftime because they had a bad experience when they were X years old and they're worried that, you know, that Devlin might do the same thing again. So they're literally, their brain, we're all built to survive, and the brain just kind of does this literally in case they're attacked. Yeah. And so that's quite shocking. So that shows you the impact of if you give a, you know, a hairdryer effect or something similar, quote unquote, at the wrong time to the wrong person. So yeah, you got to be careful. You know, the other thing that people learn from is from other sports as well. So I say to coach, the first thing is, if you want something to kind of take away, is if you can get someone to video your own halftime talk, and people will often go, well, that feels a bit weird. Well, of course it's going to feel weird. I mean, watching people back themselves is very unnatural. We find it very awkward to see ourselves, actually. That's psychologically proven. But it is probably worthwhile. And then the other thing is watch different sports. So like boxing, of course, I've kind of realized that boxing trainers can be very good at halftime intermissions. Of course, they only have 60 seconds. Yeah. And of those 60 seconds, 20 of those are the boxer just sitting down and getting his mouth guard out and getting some water and getting his cuts fixed by the cut man. And then they've got 40 seconds and they don't waffle. They deliver a message with very good authority. Whereas, you know, the average coach in rugby, it's 5 minutes, 20 seconds. In football, there's no average, but one study I read, it ranged from 1 minute to 14 minutes, head coach speech.
Wow. 14 minutes. That's insane.
That's probably like two chapters of a book.
You know? You mentioned there about like the where you would start. So I've got two questions for you. If today I said, listen, let's tackle this, let's bring you in as a federation, national federation, starting at, you know, when I would guess that you're starting at the information when people start, it starts to become like, it wouldn't be U6, it'd probably be U10, where it starts to be a bit more information. They start to be things now. How would you, I guess, would you tier it? Where would you start with bringing this into coach education to impact a culture?
Yeah, so like I work with a few football federations now in the Middle East. I've got Welsh FA as well signed up. But I only started 3 months ago, so it's ready. You know, and I'm going to the US with some meeting some teams in the States. I think it's what I find more impactful is people going through their is it UEFA A license? You know, people going through their getting their accreditation. It's generally better with younger coaches for sure, because maybe when a coach gets to a certain level, their views of needing to change are maybe quite, you know, they're much more fixed. Ideally, it works better. I think, yeah, getting if you have a team that you feel very passionate about at a youth level, just giving them maybe each week slightly more time on their own. I'm not suggesting you start from day one, like give them 6 minutes and just walk away. Just increase by 30 seconds. You know, and then also the other thing I say is, well, you ask your players. Tell me what you think of halftime. Tell me what you'd find useful. And people would be amazed what they say. But often they're not asked. They just assumes culturally that, hey, this is how it's going to work. I'm going to lecture. I'm going to talk to you for quite a long time and you're going to listen to me. Well, the data shows that's not the case, because players switch off. Unless it's impactful. Yeah.
Pep Guardiola had an Amazon show out tomorrow and listened to what Bob Marley on at halftime, you'd have millions of coaches doing that there. But it's very, very difficult to impact it from grassroots and above, almost the other direction, right? Like, it's very, soccer's largely impacted from the top down. But the problem with that is that it, a lot of people, well, vast majority are not in that world.
Yeah. And the other problem, of course, you mentioned Netflix and Amazon. They, you know, I know for a fact that, you know, one of the top teams, because when those things get released to the public, all the quote unquote good stuff gets cut out, obviously.
Yeah.
And so we all think that Pep Guardiola runs around like a, and he's not, I mean, I'm probably going to regret saying this now, but actually some of Pep Guardiola's talks don't get scored very highly. But that's another point. But I know some of the top teams have like a 2 minute enforced silence. Just, you know, of those 9 minutes or that level of that ilk, there's like 60-120 seconds where it's just like sudden silence to let players. I think that's an easy kind of something for coaches to use. And the more you do it, the more players get used to it. It'll feel weird first time. Funny, the team I coach, I do a pre-game routine. I get the team to walk around the outside of the pitch in silence in a straight line, just so players can arrive at training. And yes, it felt weird for the first month. But I think if you ask players now, they go, yeah, this is my time just for me. You know, I don't have to be anybody else. I don't have to demonstrate my knowledge of tactics or run 60-yard sprint. So I think enforced silence is another one. Can be useful. Another one, there are top teams, believe it or not, Gary, who are pumping in certain smells at halftime. So if a team is feeling very, you know, frankly, not at it, quote unquote, then a lemon zesty type smell is pumped in. But if you go into, you know, if you go into the store, you know, or Sainsbury's or supermarket, I'm playing the one I used to go in Boston actually. You know, often smells are pumped out at you, right? And that same thing's happening, and players are not even aware of this. And if the team are too hyper, then there's aromatic oils pumped in to bring the players down a little bit.
So interesting. And again,
because, you know, your subconscious is probably how we operate. We all think we're all conscious human beings and make lots of decisions, but we're kind of, you know, we're animals of habit. We do stuff out of memory, basically. Yeah.
The element of the, what you're saying there about the players arriving, just to go back to that there, I find that really interesting. I was listening to Rooney and Rio Ferdinand chatting in a taxi. There's some of the nonsense I watch on their way to Old Trafford on Rio's YouTube channel, and I just love those types of settings, just two former pros just jabbering about the old days. And Rio's asking him about phones. He's like, because Ferdinand hasn't been in the locker room in probably 10 years, Rooney obviously has, and Rooney's like, here, listen, you've got players now are on FaceTime right before. He said, I used to switch my phone off getting off the bus and switch it on coming on the bus back again. He says, now you've got people on FaceTime on their kit, and they're talking about the physical, like people looking around and seeing someone sitting in their kit on the phone. But Lampard as well talked about that, to try and enforce that, like, okay, no phones. He says, but then someone's then listening to music as a motivation thing. So almost physically now, these environments are changing completely.
Yeah, the phone was a big one. I had a big debate with a group not long ago, funny mentioned that. And then in the group in question, they had forced, as soon as all phones left on the bus before they get into the stadium. And we worked out that the players haven't got their phone for about 4 hours. And, you know, I don't know what you're like, but I'm addicted to my phone. I mean, it's never more than, you know.
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
You know, I never let my phone go dead with battery, but I probably would myself. So it's a, so you've seen people are, if you make you certain people are, or some are, you know, towards addiction levels of phone use, players are that then are by fact are in withdrawal from their phones. So I wonder, actually, maybe probably controversially, whether not players should get their phones for a minute, actually, at halftime. Because we just moved into this I would argue, Victorian's assumption that, okay, they're just bad, don't have them, let's just ban them. Okay. But we haven't retested another way, which maybe having a little bit, right? So, I've no research to back that up. But I would like someone to explore it once, because I think players will be in withdrawal. And I think that won't help their attention, because they're used to having this thing in their hand.
Hey, you could not tell me that a kid at 16, because you know what I would, if I had to sit there and I had it's right behind you if it's in a locker. You can't tell me a 16-year-old or an 18-year-old is not thinking, I wonder how many messages I have. Lampard's really interesting on that. Lampard on, I don't know who he's talking to in the interview. It came out yesterday. But he's saying, and again, this is really interesting, I think, is that you're looking for small wins as a leader as well. Mm-hmm. And if you allow someone, you know, giving someone, hey, listen, go on ahead, do that there. It's so hard to be a footballer and win games consistently, is that you're just looking for a little bit of sugar to give people at times almost.
Yeah. I mean, actually funny you mentioned, you know, so two things in that is one, I know one team now that they have an iPad, which they pass around, and the groups, everyone gets it. And it's just basically your emotions line, like how are you feeling? Happy, sad. It's a bit more complicated than that, but it gives a player like something to hold for a few seconds. They have some touch screen.
Wow.
That doesn't need to be Man City, right? You could do that in a grassroots level.
What sport's that, Eamon? Can you tell me what sport that is?
No, that's in soccer.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Youth academy level or?
No, that's much higher level, much higher.
Right.
But I think that's something that doesn't be expensive. Everyone's got an iPad. Well, most have got iPads or similar. I don't think it's the idea that you have, you know, the bit of screen time. Because you're trying to create people, like, I'm trying to think, well, how do you get, because my job is, how do you get players relaxed? How do you get them relaxed enough so they can listen to the coach? That's kind of, yeah. And so thinking, well, what's stressing these players out? I mean, there are two, if you analyze players, there's a study shown, there's about 12, 13 emotions players will generally demonstrate pre-game, you know, guilt, happiness, hope, anxiety. But the only two are probably that get in the way of performance well are anger and anxiety. They're the only two apparently which are proven to lower your performance. So I thought, okay, well, how do we get people less anxious? Well, maybe creating an environment where they can talk. There's this principle, Gary, that you haven't arrived until you've spoken. This print, I don't know where it's from, but this idea that you bring a half time, create an environment where everyone can speak, not just the two leaders in the group, or the coach and the captain. Of course, in every team, there's some quiet people and some more, but is there a way of them all sharing a little bit so they can arrive and listen? The other thing I was going to mention, Gary, by the way, is what coaches wear. So bear with me for a second. So there's research, I don't know if you've come across this before. You're laughing. Have you come across? Yeah. So
no, it's not the suit and the tracksuit, is it?
Yes. Yeah. Do you want to guess?
Yeah, I'm going to guess. Suit. Wear a suit. Every coach should wear a suit. Am I right or wrong?
Well, it's a bit more complicated than that. So if you wear a suit and you're smartly dressed or smart casual, players will perceive you as more strategically powerful. So if you look at Gareth Southgate, not that I advise Gareth Southgate, but he wears the same charcoal, right, grey type suit.
Sharp,
I'm assuming he's taken advice in that. So just to kind of remove the kind of fluctuation of, like, he doesn't wear a suit, he starts wearing a pink top one day. Why is he wearing a pink top? Even though players won't say it, they'll think that, and that you're wasting their energy. Coaches who wear tracksuits and are slim would be perceived as tactically aware. Coaches who are not so slim and wear tracksuits are not perceived well at all, actually. And I bring this up because players, you know, going back to that test we did a few weeks ago to group, you know, tell me what Gary said to you, you know, 6 minutes ago. I don't know. Do you know what he was wearing? Yeah, stripy jumper.
Yeah.
Players are more likely to remember what you're wearing than what you say. Going back to that eye thing, you know, you mentioned that the Neil Warnock halftime talk. the first thing you described was him taking his top off.
Oh, yeah. White polo. Absolutely. I can remember. Yeah.
Not the words, right? It's the demonstration you do with the eyes. That is so. If nothing else, players, if coach can kind of maybe just ponder that a little bit, players learn with their eyes. In fact, we all learn with our eyes, not just players.
Do you think, in your experiences, soccer coaches are less trusted? And I'll stay with me on this. I'm going to explain why. Than a rugby or Gaelic coach, because the soccer coach, I talked a little bit about this before we start recording, is expected to know periodization, physical loading, psychological support, tactics, rotations, management, all these things.
I think the difference is amateur show professional, actually. I'm not sure. That's one dynamic. I mean, if you look at the average tenure, was it for a football coach in top flight Europe? I think now it's 18 months. Mm. And when I speak to coach, you can almost feel the tension in the voice. It's like, hey, man, I haven't got long here to turn this round. And that leads to a lot of, you know, almost the desperation of these people at halftime. It's like, oh my God, you, God love you. You think the whole weight, the world's on your shoulders. You've all these problems in the, you know, in your own back line, and you think you're the one who can fix them. But culturally, we've created a system where we think only the coach knows the answers to these questions. Well, I think for the money involved, I think the lack of tenure increases the stress levels. Rugby, I've seen much more, measured approach. Frankly, rugby, I've argued more advanced in the halftime context because they definitely give players more time. There's more discussion going on. They're much more measured. Maybe because the coach is in a box, 100 meters away from the field of play, not getting pestered by the opposition, etc.
Yeah, but that power dynamic is so interesting because that's actually like culturally, I completely agree. Like culturally, we've created a problem. What I like about this conversation is culturally, if we're going to change it, then it starts by us approaching different behavior and open to different behaviors or trying different behaviors, I think. But as well, when you go on BBC website, you go on The Guardian, they have 8 football stories a day. 6 of them are about the coach under pressure. Culturally, that seems to be, I don't think Gaelic definitely isn't that Mickey Hart's going to get sacked tomorrow or anything got there. You know, like it seems to be that's a real tough dynamic in football.
Yeah, I think there's probably an unhealthy emphasis on, and I think that then bears in, you know, that the players then feel, you're right, it's an odd kind of dynamic, right? Because going back to this question, what is it for? And if people really, I think, give it some proper thought, well, maybe it's more for the players. But even the research, as I mentioned in the beginning, that's most of it's about the coach's point of view, which is why I thought this is nuts. Why don't we ask the players what they think? And when it did, the whole thing blew up. I mean, I think one of the other feedback points from players was, I mean, if I could summarize 18 hours of tape transcript, it would be just leave us alone. Just leave us alone.
That's powerful, isn't it? That's very powerful. I can empathize. I can see that. And I can also empathize with both sides a little bit because being in that situation and making so many mistakes with half times, like it's hard, I spoke to someone about this in a podcast a couple weeks ago. So it's hard to do nothing as a coach. Very, very difficult.
Yeah, it takes great resolve. But I think if coaches really sort of answer the question, but why are you doing it? I mean, famously, Phil Brown, right? Phil Brown, didn't he had a halftime talk, you remember, for Hull?
Yeah.
Phil Brown? His halftime talk on the pitch. Was it Man City versus Hull? And they're losing by 3-0 or something, 4-0 at halftime. And so he took the whole team out. Didn't he have the lecture on the pitch in front of his own, the away fans, and went round like this and did the fingers and... You know, I actually, I commend him for that for one reason. Those players did not forget that experience, I suspect.
This is a great conversation. I think if you're a coach listening, you're engaged or you're thinking a little bit more about this topic, which is what we set to do. Let's say that as we won't take much more of your time up. Let's say that you're a coach that struggles to get feedback. I know a lot of coaches do. Outside coaching licenses is very, very difficult for someone to be honest with you or someone to give you a little 2 or 3 points. Let's just say you're a coach in the US. I don't think it's really hard to get to video your own. You just say to the players, hey, listen, I'm going to send this in to someone, get a little bit of support, trying to improve something. Mm-hmm. Players are open to it. Would you be open to coaches reaching out to you in that regard?
Yeah, actually, very, very much so. And actually, you know, I run little sort of short halftime sort of courses, and I think I've had 4 runnings of that course, and every time, Gary, I've asked people, you either pay for it, it's not very much, but you can either pay to go in the course, or you can send a copy of your recent hat and you go for free. Have a guess how many I've been sent?
Very few, like 3 or 4.
One.
Oh, wow.
I've got 160 coaches come through. So I thought, wow, okay, that must be. And so I said, look, if you send me your example halftime talk, you know, which I can use for training purposes, but hardly anybody wants to do it because I don't know. I'm only sort of guessing what they, but yeah, very happy to, because getting, and to be honest, even getting, recording it yourself and saying to your players, look at players, I'm asking you to get better. I'm just doing the same.
Yeah.
You know what? I think that's borderline inspiring. I'm asking you to go quicker on your 10-meter sprint or your nutrition, you know, whatever the formation is, and I'm just doing the exact same. I'm trying to make sure that what I'm doing is useful to you, the players.
Right, Eamon, I've loved it. I was excited about this. Any way to change and improve an environment, I'm all ears. And this has lived up to the hype. We've done almost 1 hour and 30 minutes chatting.
Oh wow, yes, long. Yeah, we could. My wife said to me, Eamon, don't talk too much. I always talk too much. Apologies. So. So the irony, I tell coaches to say too much. I have a problem saying too much. So it's kind of ironic. It's a situation where I say too much.
Oh, that's what it's for. Brilliant. Eamon, thank you so much. Loved it.
Thank you. Well, thanks, Gary. Be in touch. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Modern Soccer Coach Podcast. For more coaching topics, sessions, and resources, head on over to Coach Kernin on Facebook or visit the website at www.modernsoccercoach.com.